Texashistory.ca is proud to present a podcast of Jay Young's recent talk, A Public Technology, Building Toronto's Yonge Street Subway, part of the Toronto Public Library's History Matters lecture series.
In September 1948, a year before construction of Toronto's Yonge Street Subway began, the chief engineer of the project addressed an agitated group of residents from Oriel Park, a respectable middle-class North Toronto neighborhood. The Oriel Park Neighborhood Association had been protesting TTC plans to build a rapid transit storage yard on nearby land that the city had recently dedicated as public parkland. This, of course, is today's Davisville subway yards. When we build this subway, there is going to be a lot of trouble, the engineer warned. But like pulling sore tooth, we'll feel better after it's over. For those responsible for the subway project, the Davisville subway yard situation represented a controversy in which some members of the public questioned aspects of the rapid transit plan, a trend that seemed likely to continue once jackhammers ripped up Yonge Street, wrecking cranes tore down residential and commercial buildings, and the creative destruction of subway construction began. My talk tonight will examine a series of events during the deliberation, construction, and early use of the original Yonge Street subway, in order to analyze how the TTC and others attempted to construct the subway as a public technology, and the degree to which such a depiction aligned with the sentiments of Torontonians. Subway promoters wanted not only its passengers, but also a general public to believe that the rapid transit line was built for all. Indeed, the Public Works Project, according to the TTC, was a material embodiment of progress for which all Torontonians should have civic enthusiasm. So I'll show that the outcome of the January 1946 subway referendum, the atmosphere of construction promoted by the TTC sidewalk superintendent program, and the celebratory mood of the subway line's jubilant opening in March 1954 indicate that a positive connection solidified between the new technology and the public. I'll suggest that aligning the subway with all members of the public attempted to reduce divisions within the city. Nonetheless, these tensions could not be completely overcome, as various controversies rose to the surface throughout the 1940s and early 1950s. The failure of the TTC to receive a 20% funding contribution from the federal government, the perils of residential expropriation for those in the path of progress, to vocal protests against the TTC's Davisville subway yards, and the financial hardships of many Yonge Street merchants during the years of subway construction conversely illustrate that rapid transit may have been symbolically built for all Torontonians, but the costs for some citizens were particularly high. The relationship between the TTC, the subway, and the public was fragile, and the Commission constantly strove to handle this fine balance to their own benefit and the success of the new subway. So planners, engineers, entrepreneurs, and local politicians had suggested various subway proposals for Toronto as early as 1909, when a British company offered to build a north-south line under Yonge Street and an east-west route under Queen. The promoters lost interest in the enterprise when the city engineer informed the company that any subway franchise would cease in 1921, the date the contract of the city's private streetcar operator expired, and thus the year that the city anticipated its own takeover of transit within the municipality. And of course, this ended up happening in 1921 when the Toronto Transportation Commission was formed, the precursor to the Toronto Transit Commission. Next slide. Thank you. So the closest the city came to building a subway in the first half of the 20th century occurred in early 1910s, as businessman and city controller Horatio C. Hocking made a system of subways the main plank of his unsuccessful 1910 mayoral campaign, although he did end up becoming mayor a couple years later. Regardless, city council established a special committee to consider underground railways and instructed the city engineer to design plans for a route traveling north from Union Station under roads nearby Yonge Street to St. Clair Avenue. Ratepayers had other ideas, however, as they rejected the $5 million scheme in 1912. Although I must note that it is from these sort of atmosphere of plans that the Bloor Street Viaduct, under construction at the same time as well, included a lower platform, which wouldn't be used until 1966 with the completion of the Bloor Danforth subway, which humorously, people say is one of the only examples of foresight that Toronto's ever As a number of factors motivated these early proposals, particularly the fact that subway offered a strategy, as I said, to sidestep the private streetcar company's surface transit monopoly, or at least cajole the private company to improve and expand its service within city boundaries. During this era, this is sort of before the 1920s, automobile congestion in Toronto was not a prominent factor. relatively few cars traveled the city's streets compared to the 1920s and subsequent decades. Toronto's early subway proposals were part of a larger trend in North America during the first decades of the 20th century. In fact, even smaller cities like Providence, Rhode Island, commissioned rapid transit reports to study the feasibility of underground routes as a means to improve their traffic problems. Next slide. It was not until the early 1940s that the TTC, which as I mentioned was formed in 1921, seriously began contemplating subways for Toronto. The rapid increase in automobiles in Toronto competed for street space with streetcars, as you see in this image here, and led to traffic congestion, threatened the decentralization of downtown industry and commerce, and thus reduced tax assessments. So by late 1941, the commission conceived an ambitious plan of transit right-of-ways centering on two streetcar subways to serve the system's busiest north-south and east-west routes, Yonge Street and Queen Street. And what I think is interesting here, as I mentioned, they're streetcar subways. So they were not originally intended to be with the large, heavy-duty transit cars that we're used to today. They would have been streetcars, and they would have actually been fed by streetcar lines. So the Yonge line would just be going directly into a portal, and then you have numerous streetcars that would enter into Queen Street, and even proposing that there would be above-ground rapid transit lines for streetcars in their own right-of-way on what is now the bike path of the Beltline Railway, which at the time was a little-used freight line. And even the Nordheimer Ravine would have been a right-of-way. But the point is, they were these streetcars that were then going to feed into an underground system. The TTC presented this plan to the mayor in a January 1942 rapid transit proposal. As the city's factories began to turn out a greater number of products for war, employment rose rapidly, and the transit system witnessed a dramatic increase in passengers and fare revenues. Wartime conditions placed further stress on the system, as the federal government restricted not only automobile use, but also immediate investment in new transit infrastructure to meet increased passenger demand. The TTC argued that it would experience a crisis with the predicted post-war increase in automobiles, which would only create further unbearable traffic congestion. Next, please. So by the early 1940s, the TTC had come to believe that rapid transit subways, essentially new underground streets, to be solely used for public transportation, provided the best solution for the city's traffic chaos. So for almost 4 years, 1941 through 1945, the commission studied and approved this rapid transit plan, including an economically minded decision in 1944 to use full-scale subway cars rather than streetcars on the Yonge Line. All this happened during wartime and within a context of what historian Len Cufford has called the culture of Reconstruction. In other words, these ideas happened within an atmosphere during wartime that post-war Canada would enjoy a more satisfying and better planned society, which I think is interesting in these subway debates that happened in the 1940s. The prominence of the subway within the city's wider post-war reconstruction plans for a more efficient and thus economically productive urban environment tied the new technology to the promise of an active municipal government directing a better managed and planned city. In June 1942, for example, Toronto established its first official planning board, whose 1943 master plan optimistically predicted a drastically expanded population and settlement area for the city. Although, interestingly, they underestimated how much growth would end up happening in subsequent decades for Toronto. In order to service this enlarged environment, the planning board urged, quote, a program of vast undertakings, such as slum clearance, for example, it ended up becoming Regent Park, a green belt, which happened in a way along the Humber and Don, but not in other areas, numerous highways, and rapid transit along Yonge and Queen Streets. Despite the prominence of rapid transit within Toronto's post-war plans, the essential issue of how to finance subway construction remained a contentious issue throughout deliberations in the 1940s. So clearly not much has changed in this side. The TTC urged the Yonge Line to be the first rapid transit line built. After all, it was the busiest streetcar line in Toronto. But who was to pay? The key issue was whether City Hall should pitch in or whether the TTC should finance the project itself, with the millions of dollars that had accumulated in fare reserves during the war, and also which would be supplemented with borrowing. TTC hoped the city would contribute 20% towards the project, since rapid transit would improve traffic conditions for all Torontonians. In early 1945, City Council rejected any contribution to the project, which put the TTC in a financial bind. Yet despite Mayor Richard Saunders' vocal hostility to city contributions, financial contributions that is, he pledged the Yonge Street subway had his wholehearted approval. In other words, the mayor did not object to the rapid transit in Toronto in principle, but rather to a specific, although certainly essential, element of the TTC's proposal, that is, its financing. This pattern of critique within greater support of the project reappears throughout the period of subway deliberation and construction, as we'll see. The dispute over subway funding between the TTC and City Council persisted until the TTC received notice from the federal government in the fall of 1945, that Ottawa tentatively accepted the rapid transit proposal for a post-war timing grant as a means to stabilize a predicted post-war economic slump. I say tentatively because the concept of timing grants still had to be accepted by the provincial governments, and it was called a timing grant, of course, because funding was predicated on an economic downturn after the war. Yet the federal government's tentative contribution removed a major financial roadblock between the TTC and City Hall. Federal funds essentially replaced the amount that the TTC had hoped the city would pay, 20%. Mayor Saunders soon called a special meeting at City Hall, in which council also decided to hold a citywide referendum on the TTC's rapid transit plans on Election Day, January 1st, 1946. So the question read.
I don't need that page.
So the question read, are you in favor of the Toronto Transportation Commission proceeding with the proposed rapid transit system, so a subway under Yonge and Queen, provided the Dominion government assumes one-fifth of the cost, and provided that the cost of taxpayers, is limited to such amounts that the City Council may agree are necessary for the replacement and improvement of city services? So I've added italics to the question's wording in order to indicate the importance to the City Council of the provisional clause of federal funds. And as I said, I'd also like to mention that by proposed rapid transit system, they mean the Yonge and also the Queen lines. December 1945 was a fervent time in the story of Toronto's first subway. The referendum period symbolized an important moment of collective political expression in making the subway a public technology. For the vote represented an overwhelming stamp of approval that legitimated subway construction from Toronto voters. William McBrien, chairman of the TTC since 1933, believed building connections with local interest groups offered the most constructive strategy to create a pro-subway citizenry. TTC rapid transit publicity took place through face-to-face public appearances with community, business, political, and church groups, somewhat like our night tonight, along with radio programs and other media events. So how did the TTC depict the future subway to Torontonians during this December 1945 referendum period? Well, images found in TTC newspaper ads and publications portrayed rapid transit as a rationally planned technology for Toronto to solve its traffic congestion crisis. These images use visual comparisons of the past or present with an imagined future of speed, efficiency, and comfort. So one ad, this was in various newspapers in December, juxtaposed photographs of current traffic bottlenecks at prominent city intersections with artistic conceptions of what rapid transit would look like once completed. Promotional material also used maps so that each Torontonian could compare the time of their present downtown commute with the quicker trip promised by Yonge and Queen Rapid Transit. Next. Another ad reminded readers of the havoc which snow placed on streetcar tracks during the previous winter, whereas the expert engineered plans for a Toronto subway would overcome the unpredictable tribulations of nature from the transit system. It's lucky for the TTC, the winter before the referendum, 1944, there were a number of really horrible snowstorms, which, it's hard to read right here, but that's basically what the ad is. So, remember last year? Remember how we were waiting for the streetcars and often barely came because of all the snow? Well, that's not going to happen if it's underground, or at least a portion of the subway will be underground. Next. The best example of an environment of technological control, similar to this weather argument, is a fascinating cutaway perspective of the intersection of Yonge and King Streets, countlessly reproduced in the TTC subway ads and publications. And so here you see King Street, and here you see Yonge Street, a really beautiful image, I think, by an artist named Serafin, who did a number of these motion artistic drawings. And I guess just two things are interesting, that I believe the drawing was done before the TDC had decided to use full-scale streetcars, subway cars, because it hints that this is sort of more of a streetcar. And also there's no third rail, so although there is an overhead wiring. But and then the third thing, second thing to note is I believe that was supposed to be a subway entrance. And you can see that it's covered, unlike today where it's not, right? It never was covered. Although some Torontonians illustrated their objections to the subway scheme with letters to newspapers, no organized opposition during the referendum period emerges in the historical record, which is interesting. In contrast, a number of influential institutions, organizations, and individuals throughout Toronto supported a yes vote. City Council, of course, unanimously supported the rapid transit scheme on its special meeting in November 1945, and the City Planning Board, unions, and prominent real estate agents also urged subways for Toronto. All three major newspapers, the Globe and Mail, the Toronto Star, and the now-defunct Telegram, supported the subway plan in principle. They did not, however, agree with specific aspects of the project. They questioned whether, for example, the Queen Line would be necessary. And most importantly, the TTC's plan for an open-cut section of the Yonge Line, covering the area north of Carleton Street, along which the subway would travel above ground, provided the greatest degree of criticism in newspaper editorials. And ultimately, a couple years later, they were able to convince the TTC to move the open cut section, I believe, up two more blocks north. But the open cut section, which emerges later on in my talk, was a point of contention. Because within the context of a severe post-war housing crisis, the open cut section would mean the removal of residences on 27 blocks, and it was an issue that did not escape the TTC. The TTC's efforts came to fruition on election day, as almost 80,000 people voted in favor of the subway, with less than 10,000 against. So basically an 8-to-1 margin voting for the subway. Not only did every ward support the plan, but a majority endorsed rapid transit in all 863 neighborhood polling subdivisions. Although I must mention that the limited municipal franchise and just simply voter indifference meant that approximately 90,000 people who did vote on the referendum represented only 24% of registered voters and 12% of the city's overall population. So something to keep in mind. The subway scheme, at least in the form presented to voters on the January 1st ballot, enjoyed an incredible amount of popular support. A number of factors explain this. First, traffic conditions along streets like Yonge were horrible, especially during the war, when streetcar lines were completely packed. Also, city taxpayers weren't being asked to contribute much financially. And the plan had the support of car drivers because putting transit underground, of course, meant more street capacity for automobiles. The initial euphoria of the subway's massive popular endorsement, however, quickly dissipated as the likelihood of the 20% grant from Ottawa increasingly became unlikely. A day after the subway vote, the Star informed its readers that there was, quote, little prospect that the rapid transit line would receive financial aid from the feds in the near future. A proposed economic or a post-war economic slump required in order for the TTC to receive Ottawa's promised funds had not occurred. Most important, the inability of the federal government to come to a suitable agreement on constitutional change of the provinces, and particularly Ontario, meant the offer of federal funds was null and void. McBrien, TTC chairman, remained optimistic. He remarked that the TTC could finance initial stages of subway construction and might not need federal funds until 2 or 3 years after construction began. It's actually fairly ambiguous if the subway referendum was legally necessary. The TTC had to apply to City Council in order to borrow money, but this didn't have to go to a public vote, unlike other forms of municipal borrowing. The TTC never indicated that it formally required a plebiscite to construct the subway, although it agreed with the idea of sending the scheme to voters. Rather, in the words of TTC Chairman McBrien, the TTC desired, quote, the nominal approval of the people of Toronto, our shareholders. Debate concerning the legitimacy and purpose of the subway referendum continually reappeared after 1946. In particular, critics argued that the lack of federal funds voided the 1946 vote, especially after Ottawa later announced it would definitely not be contributing to the rapid transit scheme. Some politicians wondered what was the point of putting the subway question to the people. Interestingly, one city controller reflected that the referendum was put to the ballot in order to get the vote out against the communists for municipal seats. In order to put the subway referendum on the ballot, more, you know, moderates will come out to vote for the subway, and, you know, hopefully not vote for the communists. Although they were, this didn't quite pan out because there was one communist on council who was elected to council that year. Another alderman now demanded a popular re-vote on the subway proposal, but the city solicitor responded that the subway vote wasn't legally necessary. He assessed that the Ontario Municipal Board, the institution that looks over municipal spending, could refuse city bonds for rapid transit, but such an outcome was improbable since subway construction would be well underway by the time the TTC required bonds, since it planned to draw its on its large reserves for the early stages of construction. Indeed, the OMB approved the TTC's first request for rapid transit debentures from the city in 1950. The city solicitor's analysis was convincing. It would be difficult for the OMB to deny debentures for a project already well underway, and the provincial board certainly would not want to be accused of prolonging construction project that already caused headaches for not only downtown businesses, but also ordinary Torontonians. For the TTC, the subway referendum served to illustrate the overwhelming popular support for the project. Indeed, New Year's Day, 1946, symbolized a key moment in the process of making the subway a public technology. The favorable subway vote, then, did not signal an end to public disputes over a number of details within the TTC's rapid transit plan. The commission continued to face a number of critiques as the subway moved from a period of initial debate to impeding construction. Supporting the subway in principle, as indicated by the ballots on Election Day, did not necessarily indicate public support for all aspects of the rapid transit proposal. The construction of the subway stalled for almost 5 years following the 1946 popular vote. While the TTC noted engineering plans were ready by early 1948, the post-war shortage of construction material and labor meant further delay in the project. But the TTC's decision to delay subway construction created an interesting situation in which Torontonians vocalized criticisms of the project while it was still on the drawing boards. The fight mounted by the Oriole Park Neighborhood Association against the TTC's proposed Davisville subway storage yard, which I quickly mentioned at the beginning of my talk, was one of the most controversial disputes during the post-referendum pre-construction period. The Davisville quagmire centered on TTC plans to place the rapid transit storage and repair yards required for the not-yet-built Yonge Street subway in a 9-acre tract of land bound by Yonge Street, Chaplain Crescent, Oriole Parkway, and the Beltline Railway, which they own here. And here's the catch. The city had dedicated 3.4 acres of this area as public parkland in 1944. We've roughly sort of the area right around here. The Davisville yard dispute exploded in 1947 when rumors emerged that the TTC wanted the parkland for a subway car. In March, local residents protested at City Hall and quickly gained support of councillors. The association depicted the TTC as unaccountable elites who possess too much influence over city planning. One resident went so far as to suggest the TTC subway yard plans were carefully kept from the general public before the successful 1946 subway referendum. The neighborhood supported the subway in principle, but argued the yard should be built at a more suitable location, such as the subway's planned northern terminus at Eglinton Avenue, the CPR station at Summerhill Avenue, and what it urged most strongly was along the waterfront. Residents connected their local fight with a call for citywide, expert-led planning that considered the needs of an active citizenry. They agreed with the dominant thinking of the era, that zoning regulations should be strictly enforced to ensure the separation of industrial from residential areas. Placing the subway yard in a residential neighborhood would industrialize the district, lower property values, and create a slum environment. It's interesting, particularly, I think, to note how neighborhood children played an important role in this Davisville dispute. In fact, a quote-unquote children's crusade knocked on doors to collect petition signatures and posed for photographs for sympathetic newspaper stories about their beloved park. Quote, "Please, Mr. Mayor, don't let them take our skating rink and park away," one petition began. Playgrounds, like the one threatened by the subway yard, reflected the post-war idealism placed in the young generation. Recreational spaces embodied the desire to teach the values of democracy and social participation to youth, and I think these factors added to the intensity of the protest. The dispute dragged on until September 1948. Mayor McCallum, worried that the controversy would become an election issue, cajoled the TTC to revise its plans. PTC rearranged its the alignment to its present north-south alignment, requiring an additional $50,000 in construction costs and the relocation of Alexander Muir Gardens north to Lawrence Park. So Alexander Muir Gardens used to be located around here, so south of the Belt Railway, and of course was moved up to Lawrence Avenue. And as you can see here, with the alignment moving from basically, you know, the subway yards are going to kind of take up this whole area right here, to move them north-south and to also take up this area here, they were able to preserve what now, of course, is Oriole Park, with a few more trees than it did back there in 1956 is when that aerial photo was taken. And so, as I said, this avoided any direct impact on the three-acre playground. After more than 19 months of controversy, the Davisville yard dispute was over. Yet the resolution of the Davisville dispute did not meet those in the path of subway progress, as vocal criticism over property expropriation and the impact of the subway on the city's landscape continued. Residents at the north end of the line complained that certain residential streets previously intersecting with Yonge Street would now become separated by the proposed open-cut ditch. This is looking south on St. Clair, of course, once the subway opened in 54. And for the purpose of my argument, it's kind of a bad picture because you can see that the residential streets do have connections to Yonge Street. But when you go north, sort of Davisville to Eglinton, there are a number of streets that were connected directly to Yonge. And after 1954 were not. I think Glebe Road is one, for example. And residents protested the city council to have forced the TDC to build bridges over the open cut, and in some cases they were successful, but in other cases they were not. More dramatically, the Yonge line required the relocation of many Torontonians. Estimates upwards to 3,000 individuals, although I kind of question that number. I think that might be a bit high, but it certainly would have seemingly have been over and into the thousands. Owners of expropriated homes living along the covered in open cut sections north of Alexander Street, where the open cut eventually began, claimed that they did not receive fair compensation for their homes, as the TDC used tax assessment rather than market assessment for their compensation. One woman, residing in a small home south of Bloor Street, lived in her modest dwelling for over 40 years and felt deeply depressed when informed that she must find new lodging. She even claimed to have suffered a heart attack on receiving notice that the TTC regarded, after receiving notice from the TTC that her property would be expropriated. Adding salt to the wound, the woman's income came from boarders, and she did not suspect the TTC's compensation would be enough to purchase a new home in the city's very hot housing market after the war. Similar to Oriole Park's claims of TTC secrecy, these victims of expropriation claimed they had also been deceived, and that's the word, deceived, by the subway referendum. One resident argued that the TTC purposely did not provide the exact details of the route until after the vote. And my research shows that although they indicated in maps, for example, in publications, approximately where the subway yard would be located, a subway line would be located, it wasn't specific. And as well, most of the public documents that I've looked at in terms of the Davisville yard, they never actually indicated where it would be in any of these publications. Another Torontonian, after hearing the TTC needed her property for the transit right of way, claimed she would not have voted yes if the referendum question had been phrased more succinctly. She thought the question asked if residents wanted the federal government to simply assist in financing the rapid transit system. While the TTC hoped the referendum illustrated the support of the general public towards the subway project, strong objections by residents regarding the details of the project demonstrated how fragile the support could be. Downtown merchants, like Oriole Park residents and other Torontonians who criticized elements of the TTC subway plans, also understood the need for rapid transit in Toronto and often displayed skepticism towards particular aspects of the project. Merchants located in the heart of the city's Yonge Street retail district worried that diversions of streetcars and automobile traffic, the increase of dust and dirt along the thoroughfare, and the repulsive noise of pile drivers during construction threatened the short-term business prospects of the businesses. However, downtown merchants also realized that subway construction was a bullet they had to bite, and some even took advantage of the fascination displayed by Torontonians towards construction. With the aid of the TTC's sidewalk superintendent program, which encouraged onlookers to observe construction work as a way for citizens to become part of the project, downtown merchants aspired to turn public observers into consumers. Yet the success of this advertising technique failed to completely overturn criticisms of the retailers, who, despite attempts at mediation by the TTC, continued to espouse the belief that subway construction hurt their bottom line. Subway construction officially started in September 1949. Commentators observing the city's downtown emphasized the general commotion subway construction caused. Instead of Toronto the orderly, Toronto the good, noted one journalist, chaos now reigns supreme, with vast yawning chasms gaping all over the place. Another reporter compared the construction site to, quote, a tired old woman whose makeup has gone awry through excessive application. Business owners blamed subway construction for declining revenues. One Yonge Street jeweler believed the subway construction was responsible for a 20% decline in business compared to an industry-wide increase of 9% across Canada. While some retailers sought compensation from the TTC, unsuccessfully, other business owners viewed subway construction as a unique business opportunity for sales promotion. Next slide. The first subway-themed advertising specials appeared in local newspapers no more than 4 days after the Yonge Subway's groundbreaking ceremony in September 1949. Joy Frocks, a Yonge Street female fashion shop, informed newspaper readers that the establishment had witnessed, quote, months of men, mud, and machinery, and we think our subway is wonderful, even if we do have to sell our beautiful new suits for only $39. Of course, the subway may have been wonderful, but it wasn't going to be open for another 4 years. The advertisement, like other subway promotions, targeted female consumers. A woman looks affectionately towards the bulldozer surrounded by hard-working laborers. Promotions continued until the opening of the subway in 1954, at which point downtown retailers switched their advertising themes to underline the convenience rapid transit now afforded downtown shoppers. As soon as construction began in September 49, Torontonians flocked to work sites on Yonge Street. Noticing the public's interest, the TTC instigated a sidewalk superintendent campaign, for which the commission approved the popular phenomenon of allowing passersby to stop and observe construction from sign lines. This did not involve the certification of lay foremen, as the name suggests. Rather, it was simply an informal publicity campaign for rapid transit. The TTC realized that instead of enforcing no standing orders, which was often common in construction sites in Toronto, it was more effective to appropriate Torontonians' natural curiosities and criticisms of subway construction by converting this interest into an innocent pastime. Unfortunately, no distinguishable paper trail exists that enables us to understand the exact motives of the TTC concerning its sidewalk superintendent promotion. But fragments of research reveal that the commission created the program as a means to inform its public of the particular details of subway construction and to bring shoppers to downtown businesses reeling from the mess. Soon after construction started, Eaton's created two popular window displays. The displays, designed by the retail giant's merchandise department with the aid of the TTC, depicted well-dressed mannequins in the latest Eaton's fashions report, watching the construction work in front of them and offering their own suggestions on the project. The display, which mirrored actual sidewalk superintendents in front of the store's windows, suggested that the mannequins represented a general public observing construction. So these are the windows that face Yonge Street from the Queen Department Store of Eaton's, which of course is Eaton Center today. So what's really fascinating is that these windows would have been facing the street where actual sidewalk superintendents would have been right in front of them. So really kind of fascinating thing going on here. But as I'm saying about this idea that the Eaton window tried to depict this idea that all sidewalk superintendents represent the general public, is this idea right here, and it's kind of cut off, but it says, we're all sidewalk superintendents. All Torontonians are sidewalk superintendents. We're all a part of this project. Eaton's, whose main department store was located at the time in the middle of the initial construction chaos of Yonge and Queen, seems to advance the idea of the use of subway sidewalk superintendents within popular discourse in Toronto. As the instructions on the display window illustrate, you stay here while I go to Eaton's and shop. The department store believed that this marketing ploy increased consumer traffic at a time when subway construction restricted the psychological and, in some cases, literal access to the site of consumption. By December 1949, the TTC commented on the popularity of the Eaton's display. Soon after, the commission released the first of four sidewalk superintendents' manuals, which explain various stages of construction in layman's terms. The pamphlets proved to be extremely popular, not only in Toronto, but also across Canada. By August 1950, the TTC had published over 60,000 copies of Grade 1 of the manual, and a second order of twice as many copies was in production. The pamphlets, four grades in total, sought to engage an imagined public in the construction of process in order to educate citizens on particular construction methods and depict the safety of rapid transit. So these folders would open up, and basically there would be text and also images, basically educating the public on how it is that the subway is being built. In line with the motivations of Eaton's, the TTC designed the manuals in part to help starving downtown businesses during the subway construction. A TTC ad in local newspapers informed readers that they could obtain copies of Grade 1 of the manual in stores fronting sections of Yonge Street, where subway construction was proceeding. So you could pick up your copies of the manual by going to these businesses that were hurting from subway construction. Not only did the Cushions pamphlets endorse the public congregation of subway construction spectators, but the TTC gave the popular pamphlets to downtown retailers for distribution, which increased their casual traffic at a time when this important demographic was severely curtailed. So what's the deal with these sidewalk superintendents? Impressions of sidewalk superintendents at the time treated the group with a high degree of interest and sardonic humor. One journalist compared the experience of sidewalk superintending to watching the Leafs play at one of the rail seats at the Gardens. Watching the excavation and construction of Toronto's subway, then, provided a sensorial thrill, tinged with danger, for the thousands of sidewalk superintendents who interrupted their usual daily pattern to observe the spectacle occurring on the city's main thoroughfare. A 1952 National Film Board short of Toronto's economic and post-war explosion concluded with a humorous, fictitious scene from the construction sidewalks. Two men cautiously, and here's a still from two men cautiously make room for an elderly woman on the safety fence. Looking at the excavation below, she quips, "Well, I hope they know what they're doing." This line, in the context of the documentary subject that is the explosion of Toronto after the war, can be read two ways, I think. A literal reference to the rapid transit project, but also a hope that the city's elites could guide the rampant growth of Toronto in positive ways. In other words, sidewalk superintendents found interest in the fact that they were literally watching the transformation of the city through the digging and jackhammering of the spaces before them. So while Eaton's, the TTC, and other suggested sidewalk superintendents drew their membership from and represented a general public, existing photographs of the construction site question this classless, non-gendered interpretation. So you see here, a majority of subway construction spectators are well-dressed men, probably on their way to or from places of business. Although dress is a particularly difficult marker of class, particularly in an earlier era when people commonly dressed in more formal attire in public, construction photographs illustrate a high proportion of fedoras, suit jackets, and trench coats on male sidewalk superintendents, especially in contrast to the soiled overalls worn by manual laborers working in the growing subway trenches. This phenomenon is explained in part by the prominence of office and other white-collar places of employment located near sites of subway excavation along downtown Yonge Street. Moreover, an even gender ratio in the Eaton sidewalk superintendent window displays earlier on does not translate the photographs of construction on them. It may be that women were inside the downtown stores when photographers took these images, as Yonge Street retailers, of course, hoped, but a more likely explanation is that the act of sidewalk superintending appealed more to male passersby compared to their female counterparts. Regardless of the class and gender distinctions present within the act of sidewalk superintending, the promotion illustrates one example of how the TTC sought to make the subway a public technology. When the subway opened, the TTC put out a souvenir booklet, and it noted, quote, the salty comment and discussion pro and con, which after all is the best possible evidence of a shared feeling of satisfaction and pride took place for this notable civic achievement. So criticizing was a way of supporting the project, of being a part of the project. The greatest benefit of sidewalk superintendent promotion for the TTC, I think, was the way in which it turned public criticism of the construction details into a form of consent. By allowing even promoting residents to observe and comment on rapid transit promotion construction, the TTC realized, at least to some degree, their goal of turning the subway project into a symbol of civic pride. On the cold day of Tuesday, March 30th, 1954, the subway finally opened to the public. Before passengers passed through turnstiles, however, the TTC held a jubilant opening ceremony at its newly minted Davisville subway station. Local television and radio stations broadcast the event, and a crowd of approximately 5,000 spectators gathered around the band shop. There, they heard speeches from PTC Chairman McBrien, Mayor Lamport, Metro Chairman Gardner, and Premier Frost that complemented the resolve of ordinary citizens, the valiant efforts of laborers, and the visions of elites and technical experts. Following this ceremony, civic leaders, celebrities, and the media boarded the subway at 11:50 a.m. and destined for Union Station, followed by a private luncheon in the Royal York Hotel ballroom. However, rapid transit opened for the public a couple hours later, 1:30 p.m. Estimates of over 200,000 passengers rode rapid transit on opening day. In anticipation of such event, the TTC placed subway trains in all stations, both north and south directions, in order to avoid the chaos of people fighting to be the first subway rider. It also chose 1:30 p.m. in the hopes that novelty riders would not interfere with the rush hour commuters using the line for the first time a couple hours later. And overall, the day went pretty smoothly, except for subway token machines temporarily running dry. Citizens and public observers used a number of tropes to understand the impact of the new subway on the city's consciousness. Newspaper writers, continuing the historic relationship between booster journalism and transportation technology, believed the subway meant Toronto was now a global city. World-class, global. You see some present trends, obviously, in the past. The journalist Ian Ball expressed this opinion the day before the subway opened in an article entitled Subway Services, Sensations, Smells Give the City Stamp of Metropolis. It argued that the majority of the world's great cities possess rapid transit systems. In fact, subways were, quote, virtually a prerequisite of the metropolis. Fashion columnist Margot also drew the connection between the rapid transit and the city's growing stature, albeit more stylish terms. Quote, now that we are New Yorkers and Londoners, as far as transportation goes, we have to keep up with the giddy pace we have set for ourselves. And this spring, the pace of clothes is colorful. After reviewing the season's latest fashion trends, of course available at downtown retailers named the Subway, Margot admitted, I don't really know what all this had to do with the Subway, but somehow we feel a little more cosmopolitan than we did yesterday. For a city with an infamous inferiority complex, the opening of its Subway, the first in Canada, provided an opportunity not only to reflect positively on the city's growth, but also its need to further develop the markers of a great metropolis. And this included, you know, the suggestion by newspapers that more subway lines were needed. The city needed to think big, need better housing, freeways, parking, recreational facilities, essentially, quote, everything that goes into the making of a modern metropolis. However, columnist Bruce West, in his article right here, felt all the talk of metropolis was a bit premature. Toronto may have 4.6 miles of subway, but true global cities such as New York and London had hundreds more. Most importantly, West felt that it was neither expanding urban space nor pushing the opening button of a new subway created a great city. I want to read a short excerpt from West's piece because I find it poetic, fascinating, and probably somewhat fitting to today's Toronto as well. So he writes, it seems to be it's always been one of our larger faults, or maybe it's a virtue, that we swing from time to time from a rather unbearable kind of modesty to an almost equally obnoxious kind of pride in dear old Toronto. An observing stranger living among us might get the impression that we aren't very sure of ourselves, or we wouldn't act this way, and he might be partly right. Someday, perhaps sooner than we expect, we may suddenly get over that particular self-consciousness that makes us yell so loudly one day about our accomplishments, then sneak around for the rest of the year feeling a little embarrassed about it. Our pulse will steady down to a nice, confident beat, and when it does, this strange and intangible change will be felt by all of us. At that moment, some of our critics in other parts of the nation will actually start liking us as well as envying us. On the evening of that day, those who have waited for it will probably won't go down to the new subway to get it. Instead, we'll probably take the ferry across the bay to the islands and sit there, in the quietness of the evening, gazing fondly upon the million twinkling lights of the city that finally found its soul. To West, then, the subway was a proud accomplishment for Toronto, but it did not make Toronto a great city. He optimistically longed for the day the Queen City became a true metropolis, when its residents began to appreciate, quote, the little ways that make a city a unique place, when its collective consciousness accepted the city's place in the world through modest self-introspection. Another common trope focused on the general atmosphere within the city after rapid transit opened to the public. Numerous commentators expressed how the subway created a carnival or a holiday atmosphere within Toronto. While it is impossible for a historian to uncover exactly how all individuals felt about the subway as they rode it trains for the first time, photographs and discussions of long queues waiting to use the subway illustrate Torontonians' display tremendous enthusiasm to experience the new technology. Witnessing the subway for the first time, from its fast-moving trains to the bright, spotless stations, was a novel experience. Unless they had been places like New York, Philadelphia, London, Paris, and a couple others, some of the few cities that had subways before this time, they had never experienced a subway. So on the big day, Torontonians traveled on the subway for pure enjoyment with no particular destination, school children skipped class to ride the new attraction like a roller coaster, and tourists arrived in the city during that week with the purpose of traversing the first rapid transit line in Canada. The feeling of novelty, based partly on the convenience of speed and comfort as promoted by the TTC, explains the numerous eyewitness accounts of happy, joyful scenes of camaraderie between strangers within the subway soon after its opening. Commuters traveled to and from work, knowing that the technology gave them more time spent in meeting with their families, compared to the crawling rush hour young streetcars. The fact that a frosty wind and a blanket of snow characterized the weather on opening day could only have emphasized the comforts of the new technology to its passengers, which, as I mentioned earlier, TTC promotions for rapid transit are argued during the referendum debate. The subway holiday trope, however, quickly transitioned to the cynical phenomenon in which new technologies become commonplace. Soon after opening, observers noted the glum nature of transit riders, and Torontonians in general, and quickly returned. The best example of this opinion is two cartoons published in humor writer Jack McLaren's satirical roast of Hawktown, appropriately called Let's All Hate Torontonians. So, first image shows a group of subway passengers on opening day. They have wide smiles on their faces and pleasant thoughts on their minds. Caption, can't read it, but I believe it says something like a happy atmosphere filled the day. Let's just start over there. The following image. underlines the morose shift, apparently 3 days later, according to the Twitter. The same riders, the exact same riders, now have grim expressions as, quote, they sat there hating each other. A new Toronto subway trope had just been created, and that has probably lasted for decades in some form. The Toronto subway is a sterile environment that sucks the life out of its tired passengers. Torontonians also offered less poetic, more practical analyses of the impact of the new subway on the subway's workings and their own lives. The city's traffic inspector, for example, remarked that the subway had led to strong improvement of traffic congestion on major north-south routes, and some businesses celebrated an increase in sales. To other businesses, however, the subway hurt revenues. The transition from numerous streetcar stops along Yonge to the more limited quantity of subway stations hurt many Yonge Street newspaper vendors and businesses, while taxi firms confirmed that the subway negatively impacted their trade. A clothing store located at Yonge and Dundas, around Yonge and Dundas, remarked the store's environs were now deserted at rush hour. Other merchants resented the fact that their possible revenues from transit riders were now being directed to Eaton's and Simpson's, which were some of the few businesses that had direct subway entrances. And the subway opening on March 54 did not mean an end of construction for plagued businesses along Yonge Street, as the replacement of hydro, telephone, and gas lines, along with the repaving of the thoroughfare, meant the downtown merchants still faced months of more construction headaches. While common compliments of efficiency, speed, and comfort of the subway filled newspaper pages and sidewalk conversations, some TTC passengers also chose to criticize certain impacts of the subway on the city's transit system. The TTC rerouted a number of its buses and streetcars into the subway stations and eliminated others, Avenue Streetcar being quite most noted, which caused inconvenience to some Torontonians who claimed that these changes actually forced them to walk a greater length. The narrow stairwells in the stations was another common public criticism after the subway opened, and other riders, particularly the elderly and the handicapped, complained that an insufficient number of escalators within the system stations, as there was only 7 on the line's 12 stations contained escalators. And this has been obviously a really interesting debate that's happened to the present, how to make the system more accessible. Yeah. So my talk tonight has surveyed a number of moments within the planning, debate, construction, and early use. Actually, next slide. I really love this next slide. My talk has talked about the planning, debate, construction, and early use of Toronto's original Yonge subway in order to understand how the TTC, along with others in the city, attempted to make the new rapid transit line a public technology. The commission wished to promote a popular perception that its major post-war work provided an instrumental benefit to all Torontonians, from the everyday passengers who relied upon the TTC's transit system to all other residents who made the city home. Moments in the subway story, such as the 1946 referendum, the sidewalk superintendent program, and the 1954 opening ceremony, illustrate how the making of the subway as public technology was a process in which the TTC and other promoters attempted to inculcate civic pride towards the project within the hearts and minds of Torontonians. Yet depicting the subway as a public technology also served to justify, or in some cases conceal, the sacrifices made by certain elements of the population. While a high majority of Torontonians who voted for the subway plebiscite supported the project enough to vote yes, a number of groups within the city faced hardships through the implementation of the plan. The TTC, under the power of the city's rapid transit expropriation bylaw, forced possibly thousands of Torontonians to sell their homes or leave their flats and move elsewhere. Some neighborhood groups predicted that particular elements of the subway project would hurt their own neighborhoods, but the movement for a comprehensively and push for a movement of comprehensively built environments. That Davis spoke of course. Downtown merchants, despite the advertising push to capitalize on construction fascination, felt the short-term brunt as pile drivers, jackhammers, and bulldozers ripped apart the city's main shopping thoroughfare. And laborers, although grateful for the employment that rapid transit construction provided, faced bodily harm as their sweat, toil built a structure supervised by others from the sidewalks. And you know, the story of labor with this construction of the subway is a whole other story that I've mentioned it in little bits in my presentation, but you know, has its own fascinating story, which is related to obviously this greater idea of the subway. Ultimately, the TTC desired to make the subway a public technology, and this demonstrates the fragile nature of building a public works project in the name of public benefit. The opening of the Yonge Street subway represented a long line of planning, selling, and constructing rapid transit in Toronto. Yet in many ways, the first ride under Yonge Street also marked the beginning of a new chapter in the city's history, as Torontonians and the TTC quickly demanded the building of more subways. One journalist noted, quote, "They can pray about their progress, it's not but a shameful sham. The rich folk got their subway, but the poor still ride the train." With the first phase in the TTC's rapid transit plan complete, residents living in the relatively less affluent areas of the eastern and western ends saw a rapid transit line of their own. Debates over benefits and costs of establishing a rapid transit system continued within the growing metropolis in subsequent decades. After discussions of the next phase of the system, discussions of the next phase of the system, an east-west subway line originally slated for Queen Street but increasingly becoming more likely under Lord Danforth, would now take place within a transformed political environment in the 1950s that included not only the city, but also its surrounding suburban municipalities within the newly formed municipality of Metro Toronto. But that's a story for another time. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Jay Young's recent talk, A Public Technology, Building Toronto's Yonge Street Subway. Check out activehistory.ca in the near future for more podcasts of the Toronto Public Library's History Matters lecture series.